Tonight's Bible reading is from Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9. On the 21st day of the seventh month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Speak to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people. Ask them, who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it seem to you like nothing? But now be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares the Lord. And work, for I am with you, declares the Lord Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt. And my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. This is what the Lord the Almighty says. In a little while, I will once more shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. I will shake all the nations, and the desired of all nations will come. And I will fill this house with glory, says the Lord Almighty. The silver is mine and the gold is mine, declares the Lord Almighty. The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says the Lord Almighty. And in this place I will grant peace, declares the Lord Almighty.
For years, William Wilberforce pushed Britain's Parliament to abolish slavery. Some of you may have seen the movie. It came out quite a long time now ago, so I can't even remember the year. Discouraged, he was about to give up when his elderly friend John Wesley, that great Methodist preacher, heard of his failing courage and asked him to come to him while he was on his deathbed. And he then called for pen and paper and he wrote, and I quote, "Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them stronger than God? Oh, be not weary of well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of his might, till even American slavery shall vanish away before it." John Wesley died 6 days later. Wilberforce never got to him, but got the letter. But 45 years later, in 1833, 3 days before his own death, slavery was abolished in Britain. Even the greatest of us need encouragement, don't we? Because life is pretty hard in this world. And there are many discouragements along the way. There are many hardships that we face. Paul, writing, says that we must go through many trials and tribulations before we enter into the presence of God. And yes, even Christians get discouraged. And even Christians get depressed. And even Christians sometimes want to throw in the towel and say, life has become overwhelming. It's all just a bit too much. And if you haven't experienced that, just wait. Because if you get old enough, you will go through very discouraging times in your life. And it's in those moments of discouragement that God comes along and through various ways, various means, brings along encouragement to us to help us to keep persevering, to keep going on. For he who began a good work in us will bring it to completion. He will finish that which he has purposed for us to do. And nothing can prevent God from accomplishing his purposes in us. And you and I need to be sensitive to one another. And we need to recognize those in our midst who are going through hardship, who are struggling in their Christian faith. Rather than condemn them, rather than judge them, we should get alongside them and seek to understand them. And seek to encourage them in their discouragement, in their questioning, in their fainting fits of faith. And we should seek to get pray for them and help them to keep on going. We need each other. God has created a church family so that in those difficult times, one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things we can do is rally alongside one another and bring messages of encouragement to one another so that we keep going. I've heard in the last few weeks, many people lament and say, we're sorry that you're going, Ian. It's hard for us. We're grieving as well. But I keep saying to them, and I keep saying to you here tonight, God's got it in hand. And God will provide someone else. And God will provide another pastor. Don't become discouraged. Hopefully God will provide someone more gifted than me and able to do much more than that God is able to be accomplished through me. So hang in there. Don't become discouraged. God's got it in hand. And God's got the future of this church in hand. So firstly, I want you to notice the encouragement of God's presence. This is so very critical. The encouragement of God's presence. Verses 1 through to 5. Let me read those verses. On the 21st day of the 7th month, the word of Yahweh came to the prophet Haggai, speak to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of all the people. Ask them. Three questions that he asks them, and all with an expected rhetorical answer. So in other words, the answer is expected. Who of you is left who saw this house in the former glory? How does it look to you now? Does it not seem to you like nothing? But now, be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares Yahweh. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares Yahweh. And work, for I am with you, declares Yahweh Almighty. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. Those verses are pregnant with meaning and pregnant with encouragement when we read them carefully. He delivers the second sermon on the day of the last day of the Feast of Booths. Now, the Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles, Leviticus 23:34, you can look it up for yourself, was a commemoration of their wilderness wanderings. And what would happen is the Israelites would build temporary shelters outside the temple and outside their homes. And those temporary shelters were meant to be built to remind them of their wilderness wanderings, that God had taken them from temporary to permanent, from out of Egypt, out of the wilderness, into the promised land. And they were meant to commemorate that as a nation. Also, during the Feast of Booths, there was a reminder of the establishment, it happened in the same month, the 7th month, of Solomon's temple that he built to God. And this is particularly pertinent because we are dealing with the rebuilding of the temple. And so it's in the midst of this that this word of the Lord comes. Now, why does it come in the midst of the 7th month? Well, the problem that is being encountered here is the people are saying, listen, we've got to get on and do the work of the temple, but all these kind of religious festivals, why do we have to do them? They're kind of inconsequential. They don't really matter. You know, let's just get on and do the work of the temple rather than pausing and celebrating these particular feasts that we are meant to do, because this is not the Passover after all. This is not the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, the new year being celebrated. This is one of those minor kind of festivals, and it's distracting us from the work. So can't we just bypass it? Can't we just get on and do the work of the temple? Now, there is tremendous application in that, isn't there? Because it's very easy as the people of God to kind of almost want to treat certain elements of Christianity as unimportant. Doesn't really matter. So let's just get through communion as quickly as we can, because, you know, I mean, we only do it once a month, and do we even have to do it once a month? I've had people at times saying to me, can't we do communion once every 6 months? And it's easy to allow those things to become almost an afterthought in our Christianity. Bible reading. Do I really have to read the Bible every day? I mean, you know, what happens if I skip for a month or 2 or 6 months? Does it really matter? And so we can add to the list those things we consider as unimportant. And here, what the prophet Haggai is saying to them is, I want to encourage you that you keep celebrating these festivals. Don't forget them. Don't neglect them. And when they're over, the work of the temple will continue and be completed according to God's timetable, not your own. How often we are prone to want to rush things, prone to want to get them finished before God is finished doing things. In our own lives, where God is working on us and busy causing us to become more and more conformed into the image of Christ, sometimes we want to rush God, particularly through the trials, don't we? We want to say, God, hurry up and let this be over. Where sometimes God says, I need to prolong the trial because there's work I'm doing in you. Hang in there. Keep persevering. Don't rush the process. We are all a work in progress. And allow God to do his work according to his timetable and not according to ours. There was another problem. And the elders here were the problem, because the elders remembered the former temple. Now there are two sets of elders here that would remember the former temple. There were some who weren't taken off into exile. Yes, there were a few who remained in the land. And so they'd been around when Solomon's temple was in all its glory before the Babylonians came in and destroyed it. And then there were those who had gone into exile who would have been very young, at a young age, when they would have seen the glory of the former temple, and they had now come back from exile, and they were looking at this temple that was being rebuilt, and they were seeing it ruins, and they were lamenting. In other words, they were reflecting on the past, and they were allowing the past to control the present, and they were allowing the past to affect the future, because in their own minds, they were thinking that temple as it now is conceived and as it is now being rebuilt will never be as glorious as the original temple. How wrong they were. Now again, there's tremendous application here. How often do you and I rely on past spiritual experiences to keep us fueled? How often do we cast our minds back to the good old days? To when God did a particular work of grace in our lives and we sense God's presence and Christianity was just a joy, and it's as if God was just carrying us on the mountaintop, and now we've been plummeted into the valley, and we reflect back nostalgically to those past experiences and we try and relive them. But you can never recapture the past, and you can never have those experiences again. And we must never allow those experiences, no matter what heights we reached, to become the thing that causes us to become discouraged in the present, thinking we will never experience that kind of spiritual experience again. Not true. Because God is still present and God is still at work. And God is still able to cause us to experience spiritual growth in a way that is meaningful. In a way that will even supersede what's happened in the past. I remember in the first church I pastored in Brisbane, of a couple there who had gone to Fiji on a kind of holiday and had gone to some churches into Fiji, where they had experienced a particular wave, if I can put it like that, of the Spirit of God moving in those churches. And years later, we're talking 15, 16, 17 years later, They were still trying to draw on that experience and sort of said, well, we've never had it that good since. And I thought, how sad that your Christianity has been on pause for all this amount of time. Don't allow past experiences to cause you not to experience God's work in your life now. God has got things in store for you that you perhaps don't even realize and know of. And God is wanting to take you on and wanting to take you higher. Never limit what God is able to do because of your past experiences. So thus, Yahweh assures them of his presence with him and says, listen, just because you had great experiences in the past, just because my presence was revealed in the temple back in some of the services when the temple was still standing in its former glory, doesn't mean that my presence is not with you now. I'm just as much with you now as I was in the past. And can I say to you as a church, when Janice and I are gone, God will just be as much present in this church as he was when we were here. And God is able to take the church on to greater spiritual heights, greater experiences. Because it's God's church. And it's God's people. And it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to God. Jesus Christ is the head. And Jesus Christ will take this church from glory to glory. And it's not dependent upon a person. It's dependent upon Jesus. And God's presence is just as much here today as it will be in the future. And the reassurance of his presence was to give them courage, determining the conviction that would cause them to know that this endeavor that they were engaged in, the rebuilding of the temple, would not fail. And God wants to say to his people, listen, just as I covenanted with Israel way back in the Exodus, that same covenant I entered into with them, I have not changed the terms of the covenant. I have not forsaken that covenant. I have not abandoned my people. That covenant that when you went into exile as a result of my discipline doesn't mean that I wasn't with you in exile. I was still with you in exile. And I'm with you now. And it's my presence that counts. Remember Moses in Exodus 33 on the Mount Sinai? Remember when God says after that rebellion and the people worship the idol down when he is on the mountaintop and Moses comes down and he sees the what's going on and he reacts to that and God says to Moses, listen, I'm going to destroy this people. And Moses says, no, Lord, you can't do that. Destroy me rather than the people. That's how much he loves his people. And then God says, okay, I won't destroy them, but my presence won't go with them. And Moses says, listen, if your presence doesn't go with us, we can't go forward. Your presence must go with us. It's our only hope. And what's true then is true for the people now, and it's true for the church of the Lord Jesus Christ in 2023. God's presence is what makes the difference. And God's presence is here when the people meet together. There is something special about meeting together on a Sunday where God presence himself with us. It was the faithfulness of God's presence in the past that encourages them in the present and encourages them to the future. They could look back and say, yes, we can see throughout our history, God has never abandoned us. How many times did Israel abandon God? How many times did they rebel? How many times did they turn away and go on their own path? And yet God continued to persevere. Can I say to you, my dear friends, it's the same in the Christian experience. Jesus is faithful to his people. Jesus doesn't abandon us because we go down paths that we ought not to go down. God is faithful. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you, he says. And he cannot forsake us for the sake of Jesus Christ who has purchased our salvation. And it's because of the finished work of Christ on the cross that God continues to exercise faithfulness towards us. Even when we are faithless, He is faithful, says Paul as he writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy. So yes, even at your worst, even when you're walking away from the Lord, even when your quiet times are an absolute mess and your prayer life is a shambles, God won't abandon you. He cannot. He remains faithful. And His presence is not with you anymore. The reason why we don't sense the presence of God in our lives is not because God has moved. We've moved. And that's why we go through those periods where we don't experience God's presence. Notice what he says. His spirit, ruach in the Hebrew, is still working in Israel. Thus they had the power of the spirit to remove all external obstacles. They were fueled by the spirit's power. And it is the same for the believer. Therefore, when Paul writes to the Ephesian church and he says, do not get drunk on Ephesians 5:18. Do not get drunk on wine. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. It is God's Spirit, and being filled with the Spirit of God doesn't mean that we get more of the Spirit as though the Spirit is given to us like a drink and we half fill and then He fills us up. No. We get more of the Spirit as we submit our lives more and more to the Lordship of Jesus. Then God's Spirit dwells more and more in us. And so Paul's writing to this Ephesian church and saying, make sure you bring yourselves under the Lordship of Christ that you might experience God's Spirit in His fullness. Is your life submitted to the Lordship of Jesus? Do you experience the presence of God because you have come before Him and you have yielded yourself to Him and you have said, Lord, take control. Take all of me. I'm not going to withhold anything to you, Jesus. Take it all. Or are we holding on to something and preventing experiencing the fullness of God's Spirit? Same command, and you just cannot read that without seeing echoes of Joshua. Be strong and courageous, he says. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from Joshua. And when we read through Joshua chapter 1, verse 6, verse 7, verse 18, maybe I should read them just to remind us of what Joshua 1:6, be strong and courageous because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers. Be strong and very courageous. Do you think he's trying to say something? Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Verse 9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For Yahweh, your God, will be with you wherever you go. Verse 18, whoever rebels against your word and does not obey your words, whatever you may command them will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Do you hear that? There is God trying to say to Joshua, listen, I know Moses is dead. You're going into this promised land and this great leader that everyone revered is gone. But be strong and courageous. Because I've got good things in store for you and my presence is with you. Oh dear Christian, God's presence is with you wherever you go. God's presence is with this church wherever He takes it. And we must never forget that. God is the one who empowers. God is the one who strengthens. God is the one who goes before us. God is the one who makes the path straight. God is the one who enables us to hurdle the difficulties in life. And so we draw on Him. I can, Philippians 4 verse 13, this is Paul who says, I've experienced good, I've experienced bad, I've been at both ends of life. And then in chapter 4 verse 13, he says, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. And then in 2 Corinthians 12 verse 9b, he says, when I'm weak, then I am strong. No, it is God's strength that fuels the believer to move into the future with absolute confidence. And when Habakkuk in chapter 3 verse 19 has come to the end of his prophecy, and the land is lying in ruins, or will be lying in ruins, this is what he says. I want to read it. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer of a feet of a deer. He enables me to go on the heights. Do you see what he's saying? That when the ground gets rocky and when it's hard and mountainous, God gives me the right kind of feet to walk on the rocky ground. The same for you and I. Whatever rocky ground lies ahead in your life personally, whatever trials may be in store for you, whatever the future may hold, God has got you covered. Not only is His presence with you, but He gives you the right kind of feet to walk the heights. George Patton was a missionary, and this is what he writes. Let me find the right page. He ministered in the New Hebrides Islands to cannibals. He began his ministry in 1858 and stayed there for over 30 years. His wife died in childbirth years after arriving on the field. Patton had many close encounters with death, told in his autobiography, 30 years with South Sea cannibals. One time, and I'm quoting now, Patton was weeding his garden when a cannibal aimed a musket on him. Patton knew that the cannibal had trained the weapon on him, but kept going down the row weeding. The cannibal kept following him. For some reason, the cannibal chose not to fire. Later, someone asked, "How did you do that?" Patton replied, "You know, if my life is over, it's over. And if it's not, I better weed the garden." God would not allow that cannibal to shoot Patton unless it was his time. And if it wasn't God's time, Patton had things to do. You and I have things to do. We have work to get engaged in. We have work to involve ourselves in. And for as long as God gives us breath, we continue to serve. We continue to roll up our sleeves. We continue to engage. For God is with us. Secondly, I want you to notice the encouragement of God's purposes. Verses 6 to 9. The encouragement of God's purposes. This is what Yahweh Almighty says. In a little while, I will once more shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations will come. And I will fill this house with glory, says Yahweh Almighty. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares Yahweh Almighty. The glory of this present house will be greater than the glory of the former house, says Yahweh Almighty. And in this place, I will grant peace, declares Yahweh Almighty. He makes his purposes more explicit. And he wants Israel to know that he who is sovereign is more than capable, according to his omnipotence, of accomplishing all that he sets out to do. He is not limited by our limitations. He is not limited by humans who sometimes put God in a box and think that God is confined to this box and can't move outside of a box. No, God has all power, and God is able to accomplish anything He chooses to accomplish. And He wants us to know His will. And so often we almost predetermine what those purposes are. And God sometimes says, "No, my purposes are different for you to what you think they are. But know this, Christian, I will accomplish all that I've set out to accomplish in your life. And no one can thwart me accomplishing those purposes, for all power resides within my hands." Notice how God frames this, and I think it's quite interesting how He frames it. He says to them, the silver and the gold is mine. In other words, the earth and everything in it is mine. And I can shift it around as I see fit. And even though these people think that they and their wealth is their wealth, and they think they've accumulated by their hands. I'm the one who stands behind it. And the wealth that I've given them, I can take that wealth away in a moment, in the blink of an eye, and I can redistribute it, and I can take it somewhere else. You look at the temple, Israel, and you see all the gold's gone, all the silver gone, all the goblets have gone. Everything's been stripped and laid bare. But I want you to know, Israel, that I'll bring it all back. And these Gentile nations that hate you, these Gentile nations, many of whom don't want you to rebuild, I will take their gold and their silver and I will bring it into the temple. And I will accomplish what I've set out to accomplish. And the shaking of the nations began when King Xerxes took over. And he came in and he shook up the nations. So God is in control of the powers to be. God raises up governments. God brings them down. There is no government, no leader, no dictator that is in power but by God's divine hand. And just as quickly as he raises them up, he can depose them and bring them down. And governments think that somehow all power resides with them. And history reveals to us that nations have risen up and God has brought nations down. And as powerful as some of those nations were and seemed to be, God can just as easily strip them of their power. And we see this with the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, the Babylonian Empire. Eventually, God dismantles them one by one. And as great as they were, they become nothing. Because God controls the nations. And the treasures belong to Him. And so what God is saying to His people, stop worrying about how you're going to fund this. I know you don't have the money. I know you think our resources are limited. How are we going to afford it? We can't pay people from foreign lands to come as they did with the first temple where Solomon had all this gold and gold became something quite common in Solomon's day and where he conscripted people, all the best tradesmen from the surrounding nations who came and helped build the temple. Only the best of the best. And now the people saying, Lord, we don't have the money to do that. And God says, don't worry about it. I've got it covered. The money will come in, and it will come in from these Gentile nations. The point that Haggai is making is that God, according to His will, is able to use even Gentiles in the accomplishment of His purposes, though they may be opposed to those purposes. In Ezra chapter 6, verses 8 to 12, I won't read them for the sake of time, but Ezra 6, 8 to 12, soon after this prophecy, those who opposed the work of the temple, those who tried to disrupt the work of the temple, soon had to pay in taxes their money in order that this temple could be refurbished. So even opposition against God came to nothing. And those who opposed the rebuilding of the temple ended up paying their taxes towards its rebuilding. Yes, God is able to take those who are diametrically opposed to His work and redistribute their finances so that His work continues. Jesus said, remember, in Matthew 16, I will build my church and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. Yes, sometimes we can become disillusioned. Sometimes we can look at the opposition. Sometimes we can see the inroads the world makes into the church and we can wonder, is it all going to continue? Is God's church, will it still be established? And even though there are some nations where God's church has almost been entirely eradicated, sooner or later there are shoots of church, a new church beginning to arise as God brings those powers down. Yes, God's church will always prevail, for it's His church. But there's not just an immediate prophecy. Sometimes prophecy has telescopic vision. So in other words, there's an immediate sense in which the prophecy is fulfilled, and then there's a more distant sense in which this prophecy is fulfilled. And that's what's going on in these verses, verses 6 to 9. There is a messianic prophecy that's going on in here, and you read carefully, you must not miss that. While the shaking of the nations and while the disruption of the earth is going to take place and while God is going to accomplish that even in the day in which the temple is being built, it's looking forward to a much greater day. It's looking forward to the day of Yahweh. And the day of Yahweh, it speaks about that judgment day when Christ shall return and when the nations shall all be shaken up of this world and God will move in judgment against those who have opposed him and he will set up his eternal throne and the Messiah will rule from that throne and there will be eternal peace. Did you see that in the final verse? And this in this place I will grant peace, declares the Lord Almighty. His point is that God will finally end all opposition. And finally, it won't be bound up with a temple, a physical structure that people come and experience God's presence. But rather, God's presence will be experienced in the person of Jesus Christ, who is the temple. And if you were here this morning, you will have heard me referring to the fact that Jesus said, destroy this temple in 3 days and I will rebuild it. And the point that Jesus was making is that the temple wasn't the big physical building, but rather his own body. He becomes the meeting place between God and man. He mediates the presence of God. And that will finally culminate in his coming, where the presence and the glory of the Lord will cover the entire earth. And all will worship him. That day is coming. And yeah, we have something of a prophecy of what that will mean. The translation, the desire, should read, the treasures, the desirable things of all the nations shall come in. All the nations will lay and bow before the Messiah one day. Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. And there will be a complete fulfillment of this prophecy, both in the present for the people of Israel and in the future for all of God's people that are gathered when Jesus Christ comes in the Messianic age. But until that time, God continues to build his church. God continues to accomplish his purposes. And God is able to do all that he has set out to do in his church. And no one can prevent him from doing that. And we therefore need to trust God. We need to rely on him. We need to realize that in spite of sometimes when we look at the obstacles that we face in the Christian church and in this church at Castle Hill, that we think, how is God going to do this? God is more than capable. Oh, that we would learn to submit and to trust and to look to him and to engage in serving him and not become discouraged when sometimes the work doesn't seem to produce the kind of fruit that we wished it would produce. Doesn't mean that God is not at work. Doesn't mean that God is not going to accomplish all that he set out to accomplish. Sometimes the way that God does it is different to the way that we conceive it. And we need to be patient, and we need to be faithful, and we need to be diligent, and we need to persevere and persevere and persevere and allow God to accomplish all that he will accomplish, both personally in our lives and more corporately for the glory of his name. I want to close with it's a bit of a long story, so hang in there. And I want to close not so that you allow the story to become the essence of the sermon, but rather that when you reflect on this passage and you remember this, that you will remember the wonderful way in which God accomplishes his sovereign purpose. So hang in there. Marcel Sternberger was a methodical man of nearly 50, with bushy white hair, guileless brown eyes, and the bouncing enthusiasm of a Siddhartist dancer of his native Hungary. He always took the 909 Long Island Railway train from his suburban home in Woodside, New York, where he caught a subway into the city. On the morning of January 10th, 1948, Sternberger boarded the 909 as usual. En route, he suddenly decided to visit Laszlo Viktor, a Hungarian friend who lived in Brooklyn and was ill. Accordingly, at Ozone Park, Sternberger changed to the subway for Brooklyn, went to his friend's house, and stayed until mid-afternoon. He then boarded the Manhattan-bound subway for his Fifth Avenue office. Here is Marcel's incredible story, and it is an incredible story, but it's going to remind you of how God is sovereign. The car was crowded, and there seemed to be no chance of a seat. But just as I entered, he's relating it now, a man sitting by the door suddenly jumped up to leave, and I slipped into the empty place. I've been living in New York long enough not to start conversations with strangers. But being a photographer, I have the peculiar habit of analyzing people's faces, and I was struck by the features of the passenger on my left. He was probably in his late 30s, and when he glanced up, his eyes seemed to have a hurt expression in them. He was reading a Hungarian language newspaper, and something prompted me to say in Hungarian, "I hope you don't mind if I glance at your paper." The man seemed surprised to be addressed in his native language, but he answered politely, "You may read it now. I'll have time to read it later on." During the half-hour ride to town, we had quite a conversation. He said his name was Bela Paskin, a law student. When World War II started, he had been put into a German labor battalion and sent to the Ukraine. Later, he was captured by the Russians and put to work burying the German dead. After the war, he covered hundreds of miles on foot until he reached his home in Debrecen, a large city in eastern Hungary. I myself knew Debrecen and quite well and talked about it for a while. Then he told me the rest of his story. When he went to the apartment once occupied by his father, mother, brothers, sisters, he found strangers living there. That was the experience of many who returned. Then he went upstairs to the apartment that he and his wife once had. It was also occupied by strangers. None of them had ever heard of the family. As he was leaving, full of sadness, a boy ran after him calling, "Paskin, Busky, Paskin, Busky." That means Uncle Paskin. The child was the son of some of the old neighbors of his. He went to the boy's home and talked to his parents. "Your whole family is dead," they told him. "The Nazis took them and your wife to Auschwitz," one of the Nazi concentration camps. Paskin gave up all hope. A few days later, too heartsick to remain any longer in Hungary, set he again out on foot, stealing across the border after border until he reached Paris. He managed to immigrate to the United States in October 1947, just 3 months before I met him. All the time he had been talking, I kept thinking to myself, some of the story sounded familiar. A young woman whom I'd recently met at the home of the friends had also been from Debrecen, and she'd been sent to Auschwitz. From there, she had transferred to work in a German munitions factory. Her relatives had been killed in the gas chambers. Later, she was liberated by the Americans and was brought here in the first boatload of displaced persons in 1946. Later, her story had moved on so much that I'd written down her address and phone number, and intending to invite her to meet my family and thus help relieve the horrible emptiness of her life. Seemed impossible that there could be any connection between these people. But as I neared my station, I fumbled anxiously in my address book. I asked in what I hoped was a casual voice, "Was your wife's name Mara?" He turned pale. "Yes," he answered. "How did you know?" He looked as if he was about to faint. I said, "Let's get off the train." I took him by the arm at the next station and led him to a phone booth. He stood there like a man in a trance while I dialed her phone number. It seemed like hours before Mara Paskin answered. Later I learned her room was alongside the telephone, but she was in the habit of never answering it because she had so few friends. The calls were always for someone else. This time, however, there was no one else at home. And after letting it ring for a while, she responded. When I heard her voice at last, I told her who I was and asked her to describe her husband. She seemed surprised at the question, but gave me a description. Then I asked her where she had lived in Debrecen, and she told me the address. Asking her to hold the line, I turned to Paskin and said, "Did you and your wife live in such and such a street?" Yes, he exclaimed. He was as white as a sheet and trembling. Try to be calm, I urged him. Something miraculous is about to happen to you. Here, take the telephone and talk to your wife. He nodded his head in mute bewilderment, his eyes bright with tears. He took the receiver, listened for a moment to his wife's voice, and suddenly cried, "This is Bela, this is Bela." And he began to mumble hysterically. Seeing that poor fellow so excited, he couldn't talk coherently. I took the receiver from his shaking hand. "Stay where you are," I told Mara, who also sounded hysterical. "I'm sending your husband to you. We will be there in 5 minutes. And you tell me God is not sovereign." What chance was it that they ended up back together because one man got on a different train in 1948? What was it, chance, or did God ride in the Brooklyn subway that afternoon? Make no mistake, dear friends. Whatever troubles you experience in this world, whatever difficulties you face, whatever challenges come your way, God will fulfill every single purpose for your life. Every single one. And every single purpose for this church by God will be fulfilled. And that is not dependent on your pastor. That is dependent on the sovereign work of Jesus Christ, who is Lord of this church. And who is at work in it for his glory. So can I encourage you, whatever you may face in this life, whatever is coming your way, hang in there. Keep going. God has got great things in store for you and this church. Amen.